sanitation basin that blocks up top water is clear and then it goes to the filters. Are utilizing lime softening, so your water is hard, fairly hard when it comes in. Through the lime softening process, it softened down to the point that you're used to now. The soften level is not planned to be changed in the treatment plant, so the water that's coming out of the new facility should be equal or better than what's coming out of the plant right now. You may have heard in some newspaper articles or some TV reports of some system struggling with some of the level of softening or pH control and corrosion, so we don't anticipate those problems here as the process isn't changing. But recarbonation, the next one, is part of that. That's where you adjust the pH to be a stable water towards slightly scale forming in the system, just like it is now. Utilizing sand filtration, the existing plant has 12 filters of various sizes. This plant will have 8 filters of the same size, although the size of the filters now are going to be the same size as your big ones in the existing plant. Chlorination, the big issue there is that we're switching from gas to liquid. Gas, although 100% strength and fairly cost effective, is worse if there's a catastrophic event. So we're switching to 12.5% sodium hypochlorite for chlorination there. Level of chlorination won't change out in the system, so that'll be about the same. Is it increased once it gets through the filters to finished water storage? 1 million gallons of on-site finished water storage compared to 500,000 that you have now.
How much would you say, I'm sorry?
Currently you have about 500,000 gallons, uh-huh. Increasing that to 1 million.
What are the two tanks hold?
That's just on site.
Okay.
You have more storage out in the system.
Yeah, Bruce asked a question related to that, I think.
So yeah, what are the two towers?
Massive use 3, right?
Yes.
3 million and Veterans Park 1.5 million.
Yes.
So you're increasing your finished water storage a little bit, which is an investment for emergency. At the same time, you have too much storage, water quality can be an issue. So they'll be able to run the clear well at different levels, lower levels. So I'm going to let Bill Sleeman talk about site and civil design criteria.
First thing we're going to look at, you know, you looked at the plan, the site, we've had the colored drawing before. The site hasn't really changed at all from locations of buildings, basins, garages, and stuff like that. That's all stayed the same. We're just going to talk really about some of the nice things that are going to happen here. The first thing you want to do is you want the curb appeal. We've got neighbors across the street. They showed up at the Plans Commission meeting for the rezoning. We know that. Not that they're unhappy, but you know, they want what's nice. They don't want to have noise and stuff. And the plant's not going to have that. You're going to have a nice looking plant in front. Not taking anything from what Barb's going to say later, but the plant's going to, you know, it's a nice looking building. It's not a metal, you know, type farm building or anything like that. It's going to have accenting lighting on it. You know, the roof lines are not just your normal peaked roofs and stuff. You know, it's going to be architecturally pretty. So the curb appeal, being a good neighbor. Part of being a good neighbor is not having flood lighting all over the place. Remember the old Warico gas station? You know, it lit up the whole corner. This is going to have LED lighting on the outside, like the new Jiffy Stop light gas station has, where the light stays more on site, it's more directed. So you won't have that flood lighting. And most of the lighting like that is behind the buildings. So you don't have nothing out in front of the buildings. It's all behind the buildings, behind the structure. So that's going to help a lot there, too. The bulk water sales is going to remain at the old plant site. So you're not going to have people coming up into the new plant with their trailers and stuff all different times of the day, you know, filling up and, you know, even on the weekends. They're still down at the old site. So you won't have that there, the new site. Site security, we know that's, you know, a big thing for it's a treatment plant. You don't want no one coming in there damaging a new plant. So it's all going to be completely surrounded with a 7-foot tall, architecturally enhanced fence in the front and also on the south side along Superior. And then it'll change the chain link fence around the back along the railroad tracks and on the north side where the industrial site is there. Repurposing the existing buildings. We know also that the north three buildings are going to be repurposed. They're not going away. They're going to be used. So we're reusing some of the sites, which is kind of being that green mode that we always talk about here. For Jack's vehicles, equipment, storage, and then for other city uses, some of the other buildings will be used. Some of the railroad coordination, we talked about, Jane talked about the permitting, we're in the process right now. We've got agreements to be on the railroad right away, to remove the trees along the railroad right away, and the trees also on the site will do that. The trees on the railroad are because we've got additional on there we've got to regrade and stuff. And also, you don't want the trees along the flocculation basin. Because then you'll be getting branches, leaves, and Jack will be cleaning that out more times than he thinks. But we don't want to have that. The stormwater detention, just like city, any other city project. You start paving property, we got to detain the water so it doesn't run off any faster than it does now. We've got two detention basins, one on the north end, one on the south end, that controls the water leaving the site. Also, part of being a good neighbor, you know, we're using the old lagoons. So you're not going to have the lagoons up on the site. They're down in the old plant area. Over the railroad tracks, out of sight, out of mind for everybody else except for the operators. That's pretty much it, except, you know, we'll demolish the old plant again, green it out somewhat, make it somewhat park space area. It is a flood, you know, flood basin area, so you can't really build much in there without going through many hoops, you know, to do the construction out in that area. The old retaining, or the old, not the old, but the sandbag wall will come down once all the construction is done, because the basins don't have to be super protected from the, you know, 100-year flood anymore.
We actually only have permission to have them for temporary flood protection. But not permanent.
Not until we're completely done with all the construction in that area will that happen. We'll be going to Plans Commission in March 4th for their approval. That's normal city operations that we got to go through for their review and their approval. Some members are here now, so you'll get to see a little bit ahead of time what's going to go on. And, you know, the other city departments will get to review on that, and the public will also comment, I'm sure. They'll be there, and hopefully we'll be able to relieve them of any concerns at night. We talked about the tree and brush removal. That is happening now because we have Indiana bats in this area. Why not Illinois bats? I don't know. But they're Indiana bats, and we can only remove the trees between, I think it's October 30th and April 1st, something like that. But we got to be done. I know April 1st is the deadline there. So if you don't get the trees out before April 1st, you're stuck another year almost for construction because we've got trees all over the site that got to be taken out. Now, we will be putting, you know, new trees back and some greenery back in some areas. So it will come back, you know, with some green areas. Now that it's going to be just an industrial site, it will look much better than, you know, you might think. You know, so there will be trees out there, there will be bushes with the fence and stuff. So we'll be coming back to the council for award on that February 9th. We're taking bids on this Friday. We had four proposals go out. All of them showed up today for the pre-bid, which is real good. You know, confident in them that they're going to go out and give us some good numbers back. They all saw each other there at the pre-bid, so they know who's there bidding it. And then we'll have them completed by March 31st, so come the end, we'll be able to start. Yes?
Can you tell me a little bit more about the fence that's going to be on the west side facing Harding Avenue?
It'll be a steel-type fence. It'll be kind of a picket fence with 1-inch pickets spaced about 6 inches apart, and then about every 75 feet, there'll be a brick pillar.
I think, Laura, you'll get a good visualization of it when you do the model.
Right.
Because this is like right across the street from where I live, near where I live, and neighbors.
And it's going to be 10 feet back behind the sidewalk, so it's not going to be right up at the sidewalk either. It'll be back further.
Perfect, thank you.
So is there anybody local for the
brush? Was they all local?
They're all local contractors. It's Littleton, T&K, Hambro, and Turner's. That's who we went out for proposals for.
When we first went into this whole design phase, that was the main thing, was being a good neighbor. I mean, that was the first thing we talked about.
Right.
You know, we didn't want the neighbors across the street, you know. So that really worked hard to make it look nice and be very friendly to the neighbors.
And I think they'll realize that because of the business that got relocated because of this project, you had a diesel mechanic out there and some others. You know, I don't know. I was out there. I don't live there, so I don't know. But I imagine the diesel mechanic probably was pretty loud at times. And they're gone, and you're not going to hear that from this, I don't think, as much. You know, you're not going to hear it out there revving engines and, you know, banging and stuff. So, I mean, you're still going to hear the humming from Reynolds, but you're not going to hear it from the plant.
For the people that lived across the street from the existing businesses, we believe that the new water treatment plant will actually be a better neighbor than those, just because it'll have a much more controlled schedule than some of the things the Bill mentioned.
Thanks, Bill.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Of course, our goal is to provide you an efficient overall design all the way down through the structure. The one big thing that I wanted to highlight for you is, because this is your water treatment plant, it's an essential facility as the building code addresses it, which really requires us to design this for a lot greater conservancy than you would if you were just designing an office building or even a school building. Some of the factors that go into this is, with the wind, you have to actually design it for 15% more than you would if it was a normal building occupation. Snow, 20% more. Seismic, 50% more. Next slide, please. On top of that, the seismic aspects of it are really pretty onerous. They require us to... actually, on top of the 1.5, we have to actually multiply that again by 1.3. And this is all based upon the type of soil conditions we have and the use of the structure, which means we end up with a lot more reinforcement in our masonry walls. The conventional construction is you would have what looks like wire mesh every other course in the masonry. Well, that's not an acceptable form of reinforcement for this type of a structure in the seismic zone that we literally just fall into. If you were one county north of us, we would have a different seismic category requirements and would dramatically reduce these requirements. I even asked our engineers two or three different times, sure, there's no way for us to, and there's just no way for us to move this into a lighter category. So we actually have to have horizontal reinforcement in our masonry walls every 48 inches as a minimum, and that's also the maximum spacing in the vertical direction as well. So it's going to be a much more reinforced structure than most of you are used to seeing if
so,
you're
so
involved
in construction. So the cost goes up too then, right?
Pardon me?
The cost then also...
It affects the cost of the building structure, yes, sir.
But it should also extend the life of it.
It definitely does, and should we have a seismic event, it should mean that we have a water plant that's still producing water when we're dealing with problems with other... The largest problem area for seismic events are unreinforced masonry buildings. Well, that's mostly what the city has in its downtown area, and every community in Illinois has in its downtown area. So, you know, from Jacksonville South is really where the seismic influence is more prevalent in Illinois. And this need for additional reinforcement isn't limited to masonry, it's also all your steel members as well. I just kind of wanted to highlight that. I mean, there are things like the way the roof diaphragm works. We can't go with an untopped precast pre-stressed concrete. It has to have actually a thin layer of cast-in-place concrete on top of it to distribute loads throughout the roof so it can distribute it to the rest of the building. That's actually been researched, and it's quite a challenge. But it'll be the right thing to do, and you'll have a building that will serve you for much longer than I'll still be around. So.
Okay, Harvey Anderson.
Okay, so now to expand a little bit on Bill's architecturally pretty common kind of Jack blending, being a good neighbor and everything. We'll get into this a little bit more as we pull up the model and kind of walk around the building and through it a little bit. But being a good neighbor, we wanted to make sure that this didn't look like an industrial or a manufacturing facility. When you see the renderings and everything, you'll see it looks more like a municipal complex. A nice building. It's been designed to keep in mind that this building is going to be here 80 plus years. So the materials that have been selected on both the inside and outside are very durable. They're low maintenance. The exterior walls are solid masonry, interior and exterior. Metal roofs, interior products like the terrazzo floor that you have out in your hallway, just things like that that we kept in mind. Also, the exterior design, looking at natural colors for the building. We have some curved roofs that kind of soften all the edges for the building. Industrial banding, horizontal banding, which is different tones and textures to the brick as we go around, which kind of helps to bring down the scale of the building a little bit. There's actually three parts to the building. One is the chemical feed, one is the area that houses the filters, and one is the administrative area. Basically, form kind of followed function with those, and we tried to minimize roof heights, so that's kind of why they ended up in sort of three separate sections, three different types of roofs, so we could minimize that in the neighborhood. You know, we've designed the facility to meet all the required building codes as well as energy codes that are required. So the building is pretty energy efficient as you look at exterior wall construction, roof construction. We've introduced natural daylight into the building in a lot of areas. It's fully accessible, meeting all the federal ADA requirements. Then we also have an opportunity for community to come in and kind of get a look at some of the treatment process, a look into the laboratory, and see some other historical displays in the building. So we'll take a look at that as we get into the model.
One thing I would like to add is Barb started on behalf of the team the coordination with Kelly Hall's office today. We've already been doing the site part of it, you know, with the rezoning. And then as Bill indicated, we'll continue that process with site plan review and eventually, when we're ready for the bidding process, we'll be more formally coordinating with Kelly Hall's office on the actual final construction documents.
Talk about the HVAC, that's what we mean by mechanical. Our goal as designers is to balance energy efficiency. You don't want to waste a single watt or BTU of gas versus reliability and serviceability. You've got to be able to work on this stuff after it's put in. So we try to strike a nice balance between efficiency and the ability to work on it. So we spec boilers and furnaces that are greater than 90% efficient. We've got really high efficiency condensing units for the air conditioning system, which we have to have in the admin building and some of the electrical buildings. Even toilet exhaust, we're taking the toilet exhaust, running it through a heat exchanger to suck the heat out of it and put it back in the building in the winter. We spec two-speed exhaust fans for the chemical areas, so you can have them slow when you need them, high speed when you need them. We're using the residual heat from the process equipment to heat some spaces. So we pumps are going to put out heat, so we're not going to have to heat those spaces. Where we have variable frequency drives, computer control systems, we have to air condition those spaces. So we've got those air conditioned. And then, this is important to me. I started life as an electrician. We've got to be able to work on this stuff. And the stuff we're specifying, we've got really skilled tradesmen here in town. I'm kind of biased with that comment because of my family. People can work on it. It's not something that you're gonna have to have somebody to run their model the way it comes to fix. On the electrical side, it's the same goal. We got to balance efficiency versus serviceability and reliability. The heart of the system is we've got a robust power distribution system. Really good switchgear. Big point two, the whole facility is going to have backups, diesel generators. So Amber has two services in that area. If either one of those fail, then you have the diesel backup, which is the first time you've had that problem. But it's size for the whole facility. For all our big motors, we're using variable frequency drives, so you can just turn the motors as fast as you need it. You don't have to turn them faster and waste any energy. Barb and Bill mentioned the lighting. We're using LED lighting wherever we can. They've got 100,000 hour life, so any place it's hard to get to, like the exterior lights, high areas in the buildings, we're putting LED lighting in to keep the maintenance down, and they're really energy efficient. Fluorescent lighting will be used in the general admin area. We're using on the exterior, Bill already mentioned it, we're using full cutoff. You know how streetlights have that globe that hang down so everybody sees them? They're annoying. These are full cutoffs, so you won't see them from a lot farther away. They focus the light down, so it shouldn't annoy your neighbors. And then for all the lights, we're putting on occupancy sensors in the interior so that
are not on until somebody walks in the room and the lights come on. Save some energy too. The control system for the plan is going to be very sophisticated computer control, but it's going to have a lot of manual override. We currently operate the plan. Jack intends to continue to do that with a lot of hands-on operators so that they know what's going on in the plan. We're going to continue to do that. But if we in the future want to extend the automation further, we're putting the wire in place to extend that program. Okay.
You mentioned about the pumps giving off heat and distributing, and that would be a cost savings if by using that.
Sure. In the high service pump area and the backwash pumps, those pumps put off heat, so we don't have to heat that space in the winter because of the heat they generate.
Okay.
Now we'll put some standby heat in case they shut down for an extended period, that they can keep the space heated, but it won't be used.
So how will that, on the opposite end of it, in the summertime, that's what, when you mentioned
that's
that.
Where you need the air conditioning.
Yes, and I was wondering, because you were talking about savings, I was wondering, does that cancel, not that it was a big deal, but just because you had mentioned that.
It does cost that, there's no choice, though. We'll have exhaust fans on there as well, which you don't have to cool. Until it gets really hot, you don't have to turn the air conditioning on. Well, you have to keep it to 104 degrees or lower in those rooms to protect the electronics.
Okay.
One of the differences from the existing water plant, if you go in the high service pump room, the VFDs and the motor are in the same room. And Jeff mentioned the VFDs need to be cooled. At this point, we have all those large horsepower VFDs in one room separate from the motors. So you can just cool that and not have to fight that motor heat all the time. And then the motors are in their own room with the pumps, and maybe, as Jeff said, ventilation is somewhere. Okay, stick with the model. We have a lot of views for you, so I'm going to be kind of going through them kind of quickly in the interest of time here. If you want to stop or you want to go back, just let me know. Plan view of the model and the existing plan on the right-hand side there. I did put the photo in there so you can kind of see how the new process units sort of fit on the existing site. Portion of the building is this area here. These are the gravity sand filters. This is the chemical feed area, the lime silos. That's the high service pump station building. That's the electrical building combined with the lake water pump station building. And these are the existing buildings that are going to be repurposed.
Jamie, is there any of the views that show where the new intake is going to be? That very first slide show that? Or?
Yeah, the new intake is going to be up here. Here's the large or the small spillway. Go by the existing plant, go up to hell, and the new intake structure is right there.
Yeah, right
by the middle of the west side. Mm-hmm.
The model is less than robust in that area. That's the area it's going to be in.
Okay. It was on the north side, right?
Yeah, right now the existing intake is right about there.
Yeah.
And there's pipes underneath the dam that bring water to the plant. Okay. Reliability, really. So that intake structure will be gone away. We'll tie into existing lines using a new intake structure, which is a lot more accessible. There's really not even any walkways to get out to the structure. And when you get there, it sways.
Yeah, right now.
And DNR,
not in good shape.
Illinois Department of Natural Resources will much prefer the location of the new intake structure compared to the current one, for the reasons that Jamie mentioned, with the pipe through the dam, that really creates a potential hazard for the dam itself.
Will it be filled in or anything once it's abandoned?
The existing intake structure?
Yeah. Mostly removed and a portion of it.
So last time we had the model, we did have all the large treatment processes in there. We've added a few things, but a lot of what we've added on the process side is sort of the connecting the dots. You know, what are the pipelines that carry the water in between? So if you take away the top topo layer, you can see that there's a lot of pipes underneath that get all the water to where it needs to go. The raw water piping is down along Superior. This is new.
What size line is that going to be?
24 inch.
Okay.
Right now, existing raw water main runs right through here to the existing plant from the wells. The lake comes from the lake, as we mentioned a second ago. Piping going to go up through to the middle of the plant. So this is all below grade. Won't be able to see that once it's all done. But it's accessible out there where you can dig it up if you need to. So the piping will come together. The well line and the lake line from the lake pump station and meet in the chemical feed valve vault. At that location is where chemical feed taps will be in here, a meter, and chemicals will be added then into the rapid mix, and that mixes the chemicals.
They usually want to flash mix the chemicals for like 15 seconds, get some work in, and then off we go into the mixing basin.
So after we go from the rapid mix, we'll go to a common splitter box, and then the flocculation water will go to each basin through a trough that's open and accessible and cleanable. A lot of scale build up in those areas, so we make sure that you can clean them and get access to them. These are the flocculation basins and the sedimentation basin. There's three separate trains. Each train is rated at 3 MGD apiece, but can be ran down below 1 MGD apiece if you need to. And that's key because you have a large range of flow that can happen, sometimes even in a short amount of time. So that flexibility, while still getting the right effluent, is important.
The redundancy really makes maintenance much more straightforward.
Sedimentation basins where all the settleable solids come out and are collected. The effluent from the sedimentation basins will be around these radial troughs here and then into the collector troughs as it goes to the recarbonation system. In the recarb basin, carbon dioxide will be added as part of a water solution feed, a carbonic acid, that adjusts the pH down from anywhere from 10 to 11, down to probably 7.5 to 8.5, probably closer to 8.
That's usually run on a seasonal basis. In the winter, you probably won't run it, just in the summer.
Right now, the plant utilizes a sulfuric acid feed, and from a safety standpoint, it's not desired. This will be a lot more accurate and give you better stabilization. So after the recarb, we go back into the chemical feed valve vault. And one of the reasons why this valve vault is here is to utilize not only the raw water, but also the recarb water going to the filters is for a short amount of distance between all the chemical feeds and this area here. You know, if a pipe breaks here and there's water, that's not too bad. We don't like that. But if chemical lines break, then chemicals are spilling everywhere. So if you can minimize those distances, it's a lot better for safety for the operators. So once the water is stabilized and you add chlorine and fluoride, go to the basement of the filter room. In the filter room, water will come into the filters in the top and come out on the bottom. This plant has the feature of filter to waste, which allows you to run a filter to get to the right turbidity before you put it back online. We use that when we need to. The water is collected in common pipes and then off to the clear well. And then when the filters are backwashed, just like you backwash a swimming pool, it's collected in these pipes and down to the slant basins.
Once you come and look at the plant after construction, that pit's going to be a lot fuller.
Yeah, there's a lot of valves and instrumentation that's not shown that just kind of comes up the picture. So there's the 8 filters, all the same size, and really the plant can run on anywhere from 6 to 7 of them at a time if they need to, so they can take a filter out, service, let it rip, whatever they need to do, and still be able to function.
Especially in the winter, less filters.
Good. Mm-hmm. It's nice to have that option because valve maintenance and those types, and in the future, media replacement.
Well, right now I have the luck of having 12 filters and I only use 6 at a time. So we originally started with six filters with bigger pipes and everything else because the square footage of the sand and gravel had to be the same for the capacity of the plant. But I wanted to see if I could get eight filters because if one or two goes down, I'd have backups. But I'm kind of spoiled now because I got plenty. So we went to the EPA, but Jamie called Leopold. They're the ones that do the filters. And of course, if you went from six to eight filters, the filters are all a little smaller valves and actuators, which open and close the valves. Saved us $120,000 by going from six to eight filters. And the EPA was fine with it. So we went out and talked to David Cook. So, you know, it was just one of those things that, you know, you always think you're adding two filters, you're going to go the other way. But we saved $120,000.
So you can be officially with the six of them to support the whole thing?
You can just use six and it'll work.
Just put the surface features back on, bringing the building up around, and so that's what the filter building looks like.
From the south.
From the south direction. This is built out here as an access hatch. Jack's hiding somewhere in this thing, somewhere, I'm sure.
He actually saved up some point.
He's checking the perimeter.
Look at my eight filters.
Yeah.
So once it comes from the filters, at that point, really, you have finished water, and we just got to store it somewhere and get it from the plant site into the distribution system. So here's where the finished water clear well is. It's below grade, like it is now. Water comes from the filters, enters into both sides of the clear well. Main difference is on the new one, you have two equally sized clear wells. Right now, you have a 500,000 and a 50,000. They're not really equal, and it's not redundant. So each clear well is the same size, and there's baffle walls in there, and that allows you to have the correct chlorine contact time and ensures that. Water flows through here and then ends up in the pump room. It's a pump sump well. Both sides are the same. You could valve off this one side, run one side, and do maintenance on the other. So the pump station has five pumps. The two on the left are backwash pumps. They'll be utilized for the backwash process as well as the spray aeration system for THMs. They're about 5,300 gallon net, a little bit bigger, but the head they have to pump in very low. So they're a low pressure pump because they just have to pump to the other side. These three are high service pumps. They're 3,000 gallon minute. They have a higher pressure. And the pressure we'll be pumping out of the plant is close to what it is now, upper 90s typically, so that won't change because really we're still pumping into the same distribution system. Vertical turbine pumps, water enters the bottom and goes up the column. These are the similar pumps that you have down in your wells. The lake water pump station also utilizes the same pumps, so we're able to get to these pumps very easily for maintenance. What's not shown is each has a roof hatch. Right now, the existing pump station had to have some holes cut for us to get the pump out. So these are prepared for that and ready to go. Chemical feed area. This is some cow wall, and Barb can talk about that further, but it's sort of lets some light in, but also these are removable panels. And behind this wall are some large diameter chemical feed storage pumps. This is the chlorine, this is the liquid alum. These are about 5,000 gallons a piece. So when those need to come out later in life, they can come out of the cow wall area. They can come out in pieces, but new ones have to go in, you know, at large scale.
And that's the bigger challenge.
Yeah. So all the chemical feed pumps, we're going to peristaltic hose pumps. All of the pumps, we were able to go with the same size for redundancy. You just have to change the hose size. These have very high turndown ratios. They're 10,000 to 1 turndown, so if you need a very high flow rate, you can crank them up. If you need something really low, just turn the speed down.